the invitation and for giving me a chance to speak here. It's a work which is not finished yet, but it's almost finished, almost typed, but not submitted. It began as a discussion joined with Joel Leibowitz, Yaakov Sinai, and then later, after this initial discussion where we just kind of indicated, outlined the general ideas and goals, then on a more technical level, I collaborated with Nander Shimani and my student, Alexei Korepanov. So that's kind of all the people who were involved in this work, plus myself. And it is based on the pretty standard model of hard balls in a container. So to illustrate the picture, here is a system of hard balls moving in a hard disks moving in a two-dimensional container. And by the container, I mean infinite strips, and we assume periodic boundary conditions. So mathematically, it's a torus. It's a torus where left and right sides are identified, so the periodic conditions are in the x directions only. And the top and bottom walls are rigid. So the disks actually reflect at the top and bottom walls, and the disks collide with each other. So because of the periodicity, this periodic structure, the number of disks is finite, n disks. But every disk is repeated with period 1. So it's a periodic configuration of disks. So what's known about this system? First of all, it preserves total kinetic energy. Say that the sum of the speed squared, the total kinetic energy is constant, and the x component of the momentum is constant. The y component of the momentum, the total momentum, of course, is not constant because balls get reflected at the wall, at the top and bottom walls. But the x component of the momentum, the sum of x component of the velocity vector. So we denote the positions of the disks by A, X, I, Y, I, and the velocity by U, I, V, I. So the total x momentum is constant. And then, of course, it's natural to set it to zero. And then the center of mass becomes constant. And so if we fit the center of mass, the x component of the center of mass, if we fit the x component of the center of mass, then let's see how many degrees of freedom. 1 degree of freedom, two, three degrees of freedom are gone. So then the phase space of the flow of the system in continuous time is 4n minus 3 dimensional, and for the map, for the collision map, the phase space is 4n minus 4 dimensional. So this system is expected generally to be hyperbolic and ergodic after all these reductions. So we expect that the flow is hyperbolic and ergodic, and collision map is hyperbolic and ergodic. This is not proven completely for arbitrary n. It's hyperbolic. I'll move it up. I'll move this board up. You will see. So it's hyperbolic plus ergodic, ergodic plus mixing, of course. All these properties are proven for n equals 2 only by Shimani. in 99. But universally, it's expected that these properties hold for every M. Okay, now I'll move it up. Yeah, I remember this. Okay. Then we were interested in the study of perturbations of this Hamiltonian system, but we were interested in perturbations of this Hamiltonian system. Perturbations designed to generate some physically interesting phenomena. These are done by twisting walls, which means that the collisions between the disks are still elastic, classical collisions, but the collisions with the walls are modified to produce something, some global trends in the system. So generally, if the particle, a disk collides with the wall and the angle of incidence is phi and the angle of reflection is psi, then the rule for psi, depending on phi, is given by a certain function. So at the bottom wall, phi and psi, the function f naught specifies that rule of collision, and at the top wall, the function f1 specifies the rule of collision. So there are two functions, generally speaking, that completely describe the collision. collisions at the walls. We still require that the speed of the particle is preserved at every collision with the wall. So it's an elastic collision in this sense. It's preserved kinetic energy of every disk at the collision. But the angle of collision is modified. Yes, so in particular, we lose the conservation of the x component of the momentum. So this system can be set up to produce some physically interesting phenomena. But first of all, these functions, we require that these functions have the following natural properties. The function f is defined on an interval from 0 to pi, and we require that it's a homeomorphism at least, or a C1 diffeomorphism, so it preserves the endpoints, and its derivative is strictly positive, and it is a small perturbation of an identity map. So the identity map, when psi equals 5, that is a classical specular reflection. So we modify it slightly. It's a small perturbation. So this is true for every I, for every f, f1, f0, and f1. We denote f0 here and f1 here because this corresponds to y equals 0 and this corresponds to y equals 1. So then, these functions may act differently. For example, if psi is always less than phi, then it means that the particles are driven to the right. Psi is bigger than phi, then the particles are driven to the left. So we do not want to see some degenerate trivial motion like everybody moves to the right or everybody moves to the left. So the first requirement we put in this model is that the functions kind of act in opposite directions. So if one drives the particles to the right, then the other drives them to the left. So this opposite action, opposite effect of those two functions means that if we kind of rotate one wall by 180 degrees, then we get exactly what happens at the other wall. So in that sense, the effect would be opposite. The opposite effect algebraically is defined by this formula: f1 of phi equals pi minus f naught of pi minus c. So if we replace phi with pi minus c, and then the action of the function would be exactly opposite. So that is that equation defines the opposite effect. It's convenient to use the involution j of phi equals pi minus c, and then in terms of j, this equation would be f1 equals j composition f naught composition j. So we impose this requirement on the functions. And there are also a special case, interesting special case, where the dynamics is time reversible. In physical terms, time reversible means that if we reverse every velocity of the disk, then the system, all the disk will travel along their path trajectories. So that is the physical definition of time reversibility. So time reversible special case is defined by this equation, f naught of pi minus f naught of phi equals pi minus phi, or in terms of that involution j, it would be f naught composition j composition f naught equals j. And the same for the other function, for f1, the same equation. In terms of graphs, if we have a graph of f naught, Yes, that's right. Yeah. So in terms of the graphs, if we have a graph of f naught, then the graph of f1 is obtained by rotation by 180 degrees. So you take that graph of f naught rotated by 180 degrees, you get the graph of f1. And this one, this case, corresponds to the graph which remains invariant under this rotation and then reflection across the diagonal. So that means that the graph itself is symmetric about the other diagonal. So it's symmetric about the line psi equals pi minus c. So that's how the time reversible functions look like. Now, there was some history of these studies. In an earlier work by Leibovitz and myself. Huh? Maybe, I'm not sure. Under these conditions, the dynamics is invertible, but not necessarily times reversible. And with this additional change, maybe, I'm not sure. I'm not sure, but maybe you're right. Mm-hmm. So in an earlier work of Leibovitz and myself, we studied this time reversible case. We did some numerical experiments, and we determined that the system develops, the system behaves like a shear flow, so that particles are driven in one direction at the top wall and in the opposite direction at the bottom wall, and then the velocity profile, if you measure the velocity of the particles, the average velocity of the particle at every level, at every horizontal level in the channel, then the velocity profile is linear. And the linear velocity profile is characteristic for shear flows, and then we kind of investigated this model. And then during this initial discussion between Leibovitz, Sinai, and myself, the goals were kind of outlined to prove something rigorously, to prove the goals are to prove hyperbolicity, then maybe the existence of SRD measure, and then its ergodicity, mixing, etc. So these are very ambitious goals. So first we looked into some kind of obstacles, what prevents us from proving these facts, these conjectures. So the big obstacle is, of course, the extent of the hyperbolicity that we begin with, that exists in the initial system, the unperturbed system, the system with elastic, with specular reflections. So the dimension or the phase space for the flow and the map, the full phase space without reduction of the x component of the moment of the total moment and the x coordinate, it's actually y coordinate, what did I say? No, it's x coordinate. Well, and the x coordinate of the center of mass, that full phase space is 4n minus 1 dimensional for the flow and 4n minus 2 dimensional for the map. The reduced phase space after we fix the total x component of the momentum and the x coordinate of the center of mass, we have 4n minus 3 and 4n minus 4. And if that conjecture holds, the initial conjecture about hyperbolicity of the original system, which I think Shimani can prove, because he proved hyperbolicity for the system of n hard disks on a torus, right? With periodic boundary conditions everywhere in every direction. This is a kind of an intermediate case. So maybe his proof can be adapted. So hyperbolicity is not so difficult to prove. But if the hyperbolicity holds, then we have 2n minus 2 positive Lyapunov exponents and 2n minus 2 negative Lyapunov exponents. It's a Hamiltonian system, so the Lyapunov spectrum is symmetric about zero. But then we have this many positive and negative Lyapunov exponents in the unperturbed system. And now, after perturbation, we don't have the conservation of momentum or the center of mass, so we have to work in the full dimensional space. Yes. No, I'm talking about the unperturbed system. The unperturbed system is Hamiltonian, so we expect this many equal number of positive and negative Lyapunov exponents, and actually totally symmetric Lyapunov spectrum. Yes, but then. Back to the perturbed system. In the perturbed system, we have to work in the full dimension. So we don't even have enough Lyapunov exponents to cover all degrees of freedom. So we may have zero Lyapunov exponents to begin with. And besides these Lyapunov exponents, even though they're non-zero, but the hyperbolicity is non-uniform and the hyperbolicity is very weak. So it's very easy to destroy. So first we looked into possible obstacles and which may destroy hyperbolicity completely. And that's what we discovered. I will present here in this talk. So first we looked into the behavior of one particle. One particle. What can one particle do? The one particle obviously collides with one wall, then collides with the opposite wall, and then the collisions with the walls alternate. So we have that initial angle phi naught, then the next angle is phi 1. That angle of reflection here becomes automatically the angle of incidence here. The next angle of reflection is phi 2, etc. So if we describe the evolution of these angles by using the functions phi naught and phi 1, then we get phi 1 equals f naught of phi naught, phi 2 equals f 1 of phi 1, etc. So we have phi 2 is phi 1 composition, f 1 composition of naught of phi naught. So the composition of these functions describes the evolution of angle of the angle of incidence at one wall. So if you call this composition G, then phi 4 would be G squared of phi 0, etc. So then the evolution of these angles we describe is described completely by the iterations of the function G. So to understand this, the behavior of this model, it's important to describe the function G. So what do we know about the function G? In terms of the J evolution, we have G equals, so it's F1 composition of naught. So this is F1. J composition F naught, composition J, composition F naught. So you see, we call that H, it becomes H squared. And H is a composition of a monotonically increasing function and the involution. So H itself is monotonically decreasing. H looks like this. It's a time-reversible diffeomorphism of this interval from 0 to pi. That's the graph of H. And it naturally has a unique fixed point. So then we are kind of wondering what kind of functions G can be represented as a square of time of orientation reversing homeomorphism or diffeomorphism of a unit interval of this interval 0 pi. So of course it's not true that any orientation preserving diffeomorphism can be expressed as a square of orientation reversing diffeomorphism. In particular, J prime of 0 would be H prime of 0 times H prime of pi by the chain rule, and that would be the same as G prime of pi. So which means that the points 0 and pi, the endpoints of the interval, are either both repelling or both attracting, so that imposes some restriction already. So we discovered that generically the function G has the following structure. The interval from 0 to pi, there is a certain special point, let's call it phi naught bar, which is a fixed point for H. So H of phi naught bar equals phi naught bar. So we call it a center. And then the structure of this interval is pretty much symmetric to the left and to the right of the center. So if we assume in generic situation we have, suppose, finitely many periodic, finitely many fixed points for G, then those fixed points, there are equal number of them to the left of this one and to the right of this one. So if we call them phi bar 1, phi bar 2, etc., and here phi bar negative 1, phi bar negative 2, these are fixed points for G. And then G takes intervals like this. The leftmost interval is taken to the rightmost interval. Which is orientation reversing deformation. H takes the leftmost interval to the rightmost interval, of course, with flipping, reversing the orientation. And then that interval is taken back here, and the H. These are fixed for G, for H squared, yeah. Yeah, So H takes this point into that one and back, so it's a periodic. All these points are periodic for H with period 2. And then this interval is taken there, and that interval is taken back here. And so the H squared, or G on these intervals, it either moves all the points toward the center or all the points away from the center. So if all these points are moved toward the center, the same happens in the symmetric interval. Then at the next interval, all the points are moved away from the center, and then so do all the points in the symmetric interval. So that's the structure for the map G. That's how G acts. So for simplicity, if we assume in the simplest case that there are only one single center, one single fixed point for G. So G has a single fixed point in the middle, not exactly in the middle, somewhere in the middle of the interval, and two endpoints. Then we have only two intervals like this. So G has three fixed points. 0, phi naught bar, and pi. It must have a fixed point between 0 and pi, because H has a fixed point. So assume that G doesn't have any other fixed points. Then we only have two intervals. So H takes with this one to the other one and the other one back here. And so in this case, either all the points in these intervals are moving toward the center. And that situation, when everything moves toward the center, we call stable center. So then the map of G looks like this. So a derivative at the center is less than 1, and the derivatives at the endpoints are greater than 1. Or the second possibility is when all the points are moved away from the center by G, and then we call that unstable center. And the graph would be something like this. The derivatives at 0 and pi are less than 1, and the derivative at the center is greater than 1. So two basics, the simplest possibilities, stable center and unstable. Because for unstable center, the endpoints will be stable, so everything will be pushed away and converged to the endpoints. Then, for that special case, time reversible, what would the function G look like? The function G is a composition of f1, f0, and you see we have it is J composition F0 composition J composition F0, and because of this F0 composition J composition F0, that is J. That is the characteristic equation for the time reversible case. So we have J squared, which is identity map. So in this special case, which is physically the most interesting, because physically this time reversibility is a natural feature of Hamiltonian systems. So in this case, the most physically interesting case, G would be the identity function. So all the points are fixed for G, and there is no stable or unstable. So there are three different interesting cases: stable center, unstable center, and time reversible special case. So we investigated the dynamics in these three cases. So I'll begin with the stable center. In this case, actually selected a particular family of functions which was convenient for theoretical analysis and for numerical experiments. A particular family of functions is this, the tangent psi equals e to the lambda tangent phi. So this equation defines psi as a function of phi, where lambda is a parameter. So lambda, when lambda equals zero, then psi equals phi, and this is a classical specular reflections. When lambda is positive, then we have stable center. And when lambda is negative, we have unstable center. And the center is always phi bar 0 is pi over 2. The center is really the midpoint of the interval. So in many respects, this is convenient. And what else is convenient about this particular family is that the inverse of the map, the inverse, corresponds to the negation of lambda. So the path trajectory of every point was exactly the same as the forward trajectory for the dynamics with negative lambda. So a lot of convenient features. Now, for the stable center, that point, pi over 2, corresponds to the vertical motion of the disk between the walls. So that is a stable motion, which means that nearby trajectories, which are almost vertical, they become more and more vertical, and they converge to the vertical regime exponentially fast. So basically, every trajectory exponentially converges to the vertical motion from either direction, from left or right. Now, for the system of several disks, what happens? Of course, intuitively, we expect that the system of several disks is chaotic, or almost chaotic. We expect that the SRB measures exist, that it's hyperbolic and everything. But on the other hand, if the initial condition in the system is almost vertical motion, then the disks would not even have a chance to approach each other, to collide. Every disk would quickly run back and forth, up and down vertically. And then the whole dynamics becomes trivial, degenerate. So first we thought it's kind of a weird possibility that doesn't happen in reality. Then we ran some numerical experiments, and we observed that from any initial condition, sooner or later, the dynamics becomes like this. It converges to the vertical motion. All the disks move just up and down vertically with different speeds. So this stable regime is characterized by the horizontal velocities uis equal to zero for all i's. So it has codimension n in the phase space, like a submanifold in the phase space of codimension n. And it's attracting. So it attracts, clearly it attracts an open set. So there is an open set in the phase space from which every trajectory converges to this stable regime. Then that phase space basically can be pictured as that stable regime in like one point here, and then a small area which is attracted to that point. We call that area U-naught. So the U-naught is attracted to the central point. But then something else comes into U-naught and then gets further attracted. So if we take the pre-image, if we could denote by T the collision map, and this is the collision space, then T inverse U-naught minus U-naught, this set, phase points from that from this set are mapped into U-naught and never come back. It will get attracted. So this set plays the role of a hole in the phase space. Everything that gets into that hole never comes back. So it's quite easy to find to determine the Lebesgue measure of U-naught. It's about lambda to the n, where lambda is that small parameter of perturbation, and n is the number of disks. the Lebesgue measure of U, if you call that set U1, the Lebesgue measure of U1 is even smaller, lambda to the n plus 1. So it's really tiny, for small lambdas, it's really tiny area, but almost every trajectory sooner or later ends up there and gets attracted. And that's kind of easy to understand because the dynamics is chaotic in most of the space. So there are collisions between the disks and so they create chaos. But then the chaotic chaotic dynamics has that feature that it sends typical trajectories end up in everywhere sooner or later. And when they end up here, they get contracted. So it acts as a whole in the phase space. So we numerically determined the average trapping time, tau bar. So the time it takes for typical trajectories to actually end up in that hole and get attracted. And we found out that it's about 1 over lambda squared. First we found that numerically after running computer experiment, and that was very, very precise picture on the graph, logarithm of lambda and logarithm of tau bar, there is a very clear straight line with a slope of 2. But then we also found a heuristic argument that explains the situation, and the heuristic argument actually gave logarithm lambda squared on top of this fraction, which is a little correction. And then we noticed, after more precise numerical experiments, we noticed that indeed that sequence of points is a bit convex. So there is some clear convexity here, which possibly comes from this logarithm correction. So everything kind of makes sense. So this picture characterizes a stable center regime. Now, for the unstable center regime, we have to look into the past. So here, in the future, almost every trajectory converges into this area. But then, in the past, if we take further and further pre-images, uk, say, is t inverse of uk minus 1. So we have u0 in the center, then we have u1 is that annulus, which is mapped into u0 at the next step. And then u2, u3, etc., their subsequent pre-images. All the sets are disjoint because the dynamics is invertible, it's a one-to-one map. And then they clearly cover the whole phase space. So a more a proper picture would be like represent the phase space as a rectangle, and then here we have u0, and then u1, and then we take further pre-images. But then you see, the dynamics runs to the left. From uk, everything is mapped to uk minus 1. But then if we run backwards, you will see what happens in the past. Everything would be mapped to the right. So there is clear also an interacting region somewhere here on the right, on the right-hand side, which corresponds to negative lambda. The inverse dynamics corresponds to the negative lambda, so that kind of gives us an idea of what to expect for negative lambda. And then we even found a good mathematical argument for the description of this dynamics in the past. So when lambda is negative means that it's unstable center, so the picture looks like this. So like there's a red graph. So in the red graph you see that when phi is above pi over 2, then psi is even bigger than phi. Psi is even bigger than phi. When phi is less than pi over 2 in this part, then psi is smaller. Then psi is smaller than, which means that in the channel, when the particle moves to the right, then after the collision it will move even faster to the right because the angle phi is bigger than the angle psi, so the angle with the wall gets smaller at every after every collision. And that happens at both walls, up and down. So the particle aligns horizontally more and more. If it moves to the left, the same thing happens. Then the angle of measured in that direction would get only smaller. So the particle aligns horizontally, either whether it moves to the right or moves to the left. So that's why the center is unstable. In this case, this vertical motion is periodic, but it's unstable. So everything is, which is close to vertical gets farther and farther away from the vertical regime. So then we realize that it's easy to illustrate for n equals 2, but the same argument applies to arbitrary n. If we consider this plane in the u1, u2 coordinates, then at collisions with the disks, DD collisions between the disks, preserve the sum of u1 and u2. Because the collisions are elastic, they preserve the total momentum, right? And then at the collisions with the wall, with the walls, if you assume that u1 and u2 are positive, which means that the x component of the velocities are positive, the particles are moving to the right. The particles are moving to the right, that means that phi is greater than, phi is less than pi over 2, then psi is even less than phi. So then the disk's wall collisions increase u1 and u2. So the velocity aligns more and more horizontally. So the x component of the velocity grows, the y component of the velocity decreases. So you see from this picture that if we like draw the disks, a disk of all possible values for u1 and u2, the boundary of the disk is determined by the total kinetic energy, of course. Then here there is a sector of this circle right here, which remains invariant. Every point in this sector behaves how? The DD collisions between the disks keep the point on the same line parallel to that chord. And the disk wall collisions push that point up or down depending on with which wall the disk collides. So that U1 plus U2 is monotonic, increases, which means that the entire sector is invariant. So that is a proof kind of the existence of an invariant area in the phase space. It's a perfectly rigorous proof. There is nothing heuristic here. So we basically, for these two cases, a stable center and a stable center, we describe the limit regimes which attract the entire phase space and and basically the dynamics collapses to some trivial motion. So in this case, the limit motion is when all the disks move in one direction, either all to the right or all to the left, and the limit velocities are vertical, so the limit velocities are characterized by Vi equals zero for every I. So so these are those two cases, and the most physically interesting case is this time reversible. Then dynamics. In this time reversible dynamics, it's not so clear what to expect because the function g is identity. There is no stable fixed point, nothing that obviously attracts anything at all. So in this case, we discovered the stable regime accidentally by running numerical experiments, and it was just totally unexpected. The stable regime, first I'll describe that regime, and then I kind of, it's not clear why it is stable at all. The regime is the symmetric motion about the central line. So the regime is the following. Two particles move with the opposite velocities. So one moves with velocity v and the other moves with velocity negative v, so the opposite velocity vectors. Then they collide with the walls simultaneously. So the collisions occur at the same moment of time. Then they get reflected from the walls, and then eventually they will collide between each other. But of course, because the velocities are opposite, and they collide with the wall simultaneously, then when they meet exactly on the central line, that collision point, that the point where the particles touch each other. It is on the line y equals 1/2. And then the outgoing velocities, post-collisional velocities, are again opposite. That's quite clear. So v prime and negative v prime. And then this regime persists, obviously. They come to the walls again with opposite velocities, collide simultaneously with the walls, and then get back to the center line, etc. So this is an invariant manifold in the phase space. It's invariant even for the original system, the Hamiltonian system of hard disks with perfectly reflecting walls. But in the original system, it means almost nothing. There are a lot of invariant manifolds there. So that's one of them. It has nothing special about it. But in this case, it happens to be stable. This regime, by the way, I described it for n equals 2. So it's maybe only a special sub-special, special case. Special case is time reversible regime, and now it's even more special, n equals 2, two disks only. So in that case, the collision space is how many dimensions? Collision space is 4n minus 2, so it's 10 dimensional. No, 6. 6-dimensional, 4n minus 2. For 6-dimensional collision space, and this is a 3-dimensional submanifold. Why is it 3-dimensional? Because when the particles collide, then first of all, the direction of the velocity vector, that's 1 degree of freedom, then the relative position can have rotated about the same point, so that the relative position of the disks is one more degree of freedom, and the x-coordinate of the collision point is another degree of freedom, so 3 degrees of freedom, so it's three-dimensional submanifold in the collision space. So it is stable, which we discovered numerically by a computer experiment, and then we found heuristic argument. We at least in the local sense, we consider a small perturbation of an arbitrary point in this three-dimensional manifold, and we show that eventually that perturbation gets smaller, converges to zero. So by heuristic argument, it's not totally rigorous. So heuristic argument shows that it's indeed stable. So in this case, there is a stable regime, which is very strange, which is unexpected. There is no intuitive explanation that we can provide for this, and only heuristic argument that supports stability. What's also interesting about it is that the stable regime doesn't mean that there is an FRD measure in any sense. The definition of a physically observable measure as I learned from papers by Les and Young. That means that a measure which attracts the set in the phase space of positive Lebesgue measure, right? So that is the definition. In this case, there is nothing, no measure that attracts a positive, a set of positive Lebesgue measure. Because of this x coordinate, basically what it means that is that if you pick an arbitrary phase point, capital X, in the collision space, then that point converges eventually, which we believe is true, we only have heuristic argument, the trajectory of this point converges to this manifold, so these collisions become symmetric. But as they become symmetric, the X-coordinate, by the way, never changes. The X-coordinate of the center of mass never changes because of the opposite velocities. The total momentum is zero. The total momentum is zero, so the center of mass doesn't move. The center of mass is preserved. So the x component of the collision point never changes. All the collisions occur exactly in the same space. So x coordinate becomes like a first integral. So when an arbitrarily selected point in the phase space converges to a stable regime, it converges to some particular x coordinate. Other phase points may converge to the stable regime with a different x coordinate of the center of mass. So every single point x attracts something, but that something has Lebesgue measure zero, because if it had positive Lebesgue measure, then different points with different x coordinates would attract also sets with positive measure, but that's impossible. So that shows that here, even though there is a clear attracting regime, it's not a physically observable measure. Those such measures do not exist. So basically, the moral of this work is to demonstrate that even though we begin with a Hamiltonian system which is unstable, then arbitrarily small perturbations may completely destroy the motion, and the whole dynamics collapses to something totally trivial and simple and not physically meaningful at all. So that's kind of what we discovered. Right, thank you.